One of the startling effects of war sometimes is to galvanise innovation. It is a matter of record that the clever boffins behind penicillin, radar and the invention of modern computing managed to produce results in 3 or 4 years. Nowadays you can't even get the funding committee to give you the go-ahead for a project within a decade. In fact, it's been revealed that American scientists spend 42% of their time on admin rather than research, and here in Australia something like 500 years has been spent on paper shuffling rather than lab work. Having said that, it's interesting to recall that Howard Florey, the genius from Adelaide behind penicillin, said their motivation was good science rather than trying to win the war. Dr. Ron Summers is also from Adelaide, works in public health, and has long been bothered by the gap between discovery and its application.
During my 30 years of scientific work in Australia, I've met some strange people, but none stranger than a band of friends and acquaintances who qualify as truly bizarre. These people are all heavy gamblers. Well, gamblers of a sort, but I'll leave it to you to decide whether or not they qualify as problem gamblers. The thing that makes these people so strange is that they get their jollies from the success of their gamble, and they don't give two hoots about their winnings. They generally walk away from the gaming table, leaving their mountain of chips behind. You might say that they're purists. To them, gambling is about making the winning bet, not about the benefits that flow from the winning bet. My guess is that listeners know lots of similar people, or at least know of them, but perhaps by names other than gambling purists. They're more often known as scientists and researchers. The folk who gamble enormous amounts of time, energy, and money, and are rewarded, when they strike it lucky, with the publications and prizes, the kudos, and careers. It is beneath many of them, or perhaps simply beyond them, to cash in their chips by actively working to push their discoveries into policies and practices. Okay, fair enough. The people who are gifted in discovery are not necessarily the people most talented in promoting ideas. But if this is the reality we must work around, then Australia needs to start training up some people whose skill sets bridge the gap between discovery and application. What we are presently doing, including on this show, to publicly promote science as a fulfilling career, is great, really great. But Australia also needs to define a career path specifically in science translation. If I want my bathroom plumbing fixed, I can contact a person whom society has thoughtfully trained to do this technical job. If I want to ensure that my children and I are protected by recent scientific discoveries, there is no one to depend upon, no one who is trained in the alchemy of implementing progress. I'm left to conclude that my toilet is more important to society than my life and my well-being. There are, in my view, three fundamental impediments to human progress. The first impediment comprises all the useful things yet to be discovered. The second impediment to progress comprises all the useful discoveries that we have made but can't afford to capitalize on. And the third impediment comprises all the useful discoveries that we have made and can afford but still ignore. These latter are the chips inexplicably left on the gaming table, the opportunities foregone, the lives we could easily have saved if we had just got ourselves organized. In our everyday discourse concerning our comings and goings, we often rationalize our disappointments with the observation that, oh well, it isn't a matter of life and death. Well, what I'm talking about is a matter of life and death. And a warning here, listeners who are at all squeamish about the naked truth should tune out now. To the extent that it is possible using radio waves alone, I'm about to conjure up a very disturbing picture, one that keeps me up at night. In 2005, an article appeared in an international journal by a group of authors based at the Institute of Child Health in London. These people looked back to the 1940s in an effort to track how official parenting advice evolved on the one hand, and how scientific knowledge evolved on the other. The specific issue they were interested in was not a highly technical one. The question was simply whether infants, in their first 12 months of life, should be positioned face up to sleep or face down. In other words, was a tiny tot safer sleeping on its back or on its tummy? This isn't a purely academic question because infants are known to suffocate while sleeping, and such cases form part of the sudden infant death syndrome. Admittedly, some infants have died while face up, and other infants have died while face down. But what are the odds? That's the question. Which sleep position is statistically riskier? And moreover, had the advice to parents kept pace with advances in our understanding of the relative risks? Well, the answer is no. Advice to parents had not kept pace with the scientific knowledge. By 1970, there was enough cumulative research to conclude with confidence that infants are at much less risk of suffocation when they are placed face up. However, these research findings were not reflected in the advice to parents until some 22 years later. As a direct consequence of the delay, upwards of 60,000 infants died in Europe, the UK, North America, and Australia. That's 60,000 otherwise healthy infants who died as a result of bad, outdated advice. I hasten to point out that the cost of providing bad advice was no less than the cost of providing good advice. In trying to figure out exactly who was to blame for this tragedy, I can't escape the conclusion that we, adult society in general, are the culprits. We allowed this to happen because we did not sufficiently value the translation of science into action, and we did not sufficiently recognize the role of advocates for change. The average person could be forgiven for assuming that new knowledge is sufficient on its own to drive change. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Even very good and affordable ideas require champions to promote them. Unfortunately, the collective blindness that resulted in all those dead babies continues to plague us, and to an ever-increasing extent. As the explosion in knowledge uncovers more and more opportunities for beneficial action, the stagnation in knowledge translation means that the number of missed opportunities is exploding as well. Examples of this abound. For example, children are required by Australian law to use booster seats in cars only up to age 7, whereas we know that they are safer using booster seats until age 11 or 12. We likewise know the injury consequences of falling from a height onto a hard surface, but there is no regulatory requirement for cushioning playgrounds with wood chip or rubber. Infants are known to die sleeping on overly soft mattresses, but there is no prohibition of unsafe baby products that are dangerously soft. Research shows clearly that drinking optimally fluoridated water is the best way to prevent tooth decay, but many Australian children do not have access to fluoridated water. And the list goes on and on. I think that our universities need to take the lead here, to define a curriculum that trains social entrepreneurs who are simultaneously competent in both science and ideas promotion. Graduates of such programs could see themselves, and be seen by the rest of us, as our much-needed agents of change. These are the people who would have the skills to fully understand the evidence and the vision to see the practical implications of it. These are the people who could coax the scientific community into playing a more direct role in promoting progress, and could coax the rest of us into a more comfortable acceptance of progress. I've been riding this particular hobby horse for some time, and I have the saddle sores to prove it. In the early 1990s, I was invited to present a speech at an international conference held in Sydney. I knew that the world's best and brightest in my research field would be in attendance. Although I was not in their league and was unlikely ever to be, I had been a student of some of them and a colleague of others. I guessed, correctly, that this would be my one and only chance to influence them, and I was determined not to waste the opportunity. I chose an unusual topic and an unusual style in which to present it. When I finished, I received a very warm acknowledgement. After all, I had been the first ever in that forum to argue my point using a cartoon and poetry. More importantly, I was the first ever to say that those with insider knowledge of scientific discoveries naturally wielded the most credibility in advocating for discovery-based change. During the question period that followed my presentation, the world's greats stood up, one by one in the audience, and announced, firstly, how much they had enjoyed my entertaining presentation, and secondly, how thoroughly they disagreed with my main point. It was not their role to initiate practical changes. They were scientists. It was up to someone else to do that. They didn't know exactly who that someone else might be, but I do. And I'm waiting for them to come. I'm hoping that one day soon they appear in sufficient numbers to help us to more effectively apply what we already know.
Yes, I think we're all waiting, Dr. Summers. Ron Summers is with Public Health at the University of Adelaide, and I suppose it's the job of science communicators to advise on the kinds of findings that he talked about and how we should respond to them. But all this is made more difficult by two things these days: the internet with all its confusion, and litigation. Who dares advise on risk when it could be lawyers at 10 paces? Next week, language and the nature of society. Are we just numbers of individuals or collections of communities? And when did all that change? And I'm not talking about Mrs. Thatcher and those words about society. I'm Robin Williams.